Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with a book show on ABC Radio National. Today, New York Review of Books editor Robert Silvers talks with me about French writer Marguerite Duras, Italian hero Giuseppe Garibaldi, and someone who could become very familiar to us in the lead-up to the US presidential election, writer-turned-Democrat politician Jim Webb. And also, Simon Cleary's debut novel is The Comfort of Figs, a creation story about Brisbane and about the rift between a father who built a bridge at the heart of Brisbane and the son who's obsessive about planting fig trees. And even later, the third episode of An Angel at My Table by New Zealand writer Janet Frame. But first to an article in the Boston Globe reporting on the pressure on best-selling authors to produce a book a year. According to book marketing experts, this is the magic formula that keeps readers of blockbusters like John Grisham interested. They're afraid that in today's intensely competitive marketplace for a dwindling number of book buyers in this age of mass electronic entertainment, readers will turn to another author if a writer fails the yearly deadline, especially in the thriller and suspense genres. Apparently they don't want the thrill and suspense of wondering where the manuscript is. Apparently the publishers have to book and pay for space at the front of the bookshops in advance, so they've rented the space and they want the book to put in there. Some writers contend that time pressure corrodes their work. And the Globe reports Dennis Lehane, who tried the book a year pace once to his regret. Apparently the week a rushed book was published, he realised what would have made it into a really good book, and he got very, very angry. And he went on to say that, "I said I'd never go back on that hamster wheel. It's what led me to write Mystic River." He took 2 years, published it in 2001, and it was his biggest book ever. And apparently the 2003 movie of the book, of the slow book, won 2 Academy Awards. So that should have kept the marketing people happy. But now to the man at the helm of the New York Review of Books, Robert Silvers. Robert, welcome again to the book show.
Great to be here.
Now, first, with the presidential election looming, as it seems to have been for almost years now, let's look at someone who could well emerge as a major figure in the future Democrat government, if that's what happens, but who few people in Australia will have heard of, Jim Webb. This is a man who's being touted as a serious contender for vice presidential running mate with Barack Obama. But he's also a remarkable character in his own right, with a public profile that's equal parts war hero and writer. His first book, Fields of Fire, written in 1978, has been called the best book about the Vietnam War, and his writing, along with a passion for boxing, has had him compared to the late Norman Mailer. He's a screenwriter and a documentary producer, but so much of Jim Webb's reputation revolves around his experiences and attitudes to war. So Bob Silvers, the war hero tag gets trotted out so often. What does Jim Webb actually appear to be to you? What do you make of him?
Well, I'll tell you, the key, here are two keys to Jim Webb. One is he wouldn't be where he is if he were not unexpectedly elected. And just in 2006, a senator from Virginia, which he is, a Democratic senator, and he beat a man, a Republican, who was very popular, called George Allen. This Allen had a father who was a famous football coach, and which you can't beat, really. And yet, Allen made a terrible remark at a rally. He called an Indian gentleman a macaca, which is a great insult, and that did him in. And Webb won the election. And then, of course, people knew Webb because he'd been a Secretary of the Navy under Reagan. He is a Reagan Democrat. He was a Democrat. He comes from an old Southern, rather countryside village in Upper Virginia, and he comes from people who are fighters who are in Confederate Army and in every army, and he fought in Vietnam. He wrote about it. Very military fellow, And he got elected senator, and he hated the idea of the Iraq War. He thought it would be ruinous for the troops, ruinous for the country. He opposed it from the first. So here you had a man who was and he had made his money before running between being Secretary of the Navy and running for Senate by writing these 12 books, all about war and about the Vietnam War and about, and above all, about the Scotch-Irish. He's Scotch-Irish. He believes in the Scotch-Irish population in America as a much discriminated against and yet very sturdy and excellent people.
His latest book is called A Time to Fight, Reclaiming a Fair and Just America, and it seems to be something of a personal manifesto, one that seems like a tacit pitch for high office. Is that what it is?
Well, it is. It is. It certainly was written probably with the idea that he had a national future, but with nothing very specific. And you see, one of the big problems with Barack Obama is that although he's very popular with many Democrats, he's lost to Hillary Clinton among poorer workers, lower-income workers, in white workers, in Pennsylvania, in West Virginia, in Kentucky. And and although he won in Virginia, in the Appalachian area from which Mr. Webb comes, he was not popular. And so here we have a Reagan Democrat, and of course everyone wants to somehow get back into the Democratic fold, the Reagan Democrats. And he is one. And he's a military gent, and therefore can stand up on his own feet against McCain and against the proponents of the Iraq War.
He's been described by some as a bit weird and unconventional, and he's certainly not prone to acts of subtlety. He apparently refused to shake President Bush's hand at a White House dinner when he first gained a Senate seat.
Yes,
what was that about?
It was in a reception, and Bush went up to him and said, "How's your boy?" His son serving in Iraq. Well, Webb said, "You know, Mr. President, I want to get our troops home." And Bush then said very belligerently, "I didn't ask you that. I asked you, how's your boy?" And Webb then replied, "Mr. President, that's between me and my boy." Now, that was made much of, and of course, Webb, who's really quite a gentleman, later on said, "Well, we mustn't make too much of it." And the President and I met afterward. We smoothed it over. We disagree about the war, but of course, we're concerned about the young men there. So he got over that thing, and in fact, Bush didn't look so great in the way he challenged him. But he is a man of some, let us say, sturdiness, some belligerence when challenged, and he's very proud of the Scotch-Irish military cavalier tradition, and he's written these books, which are really quite clearly and well written.
Do you think he's made enough of a name for himself for the Democratic Party machine to endorse him as vice presidential candidate?
Hard to say. He's certainly well known in the South. He's known in Virginia. He's known in that part of the world, the part of the world that Obama needs badly. And also, you know, in our system, the presidential spotlight is so enormous, and the campaign is such a far-reaching event in every household, that once you start campaigning, you do get known, you do get attention, and you become a personality very quickly. And he is quite a strong personality.
Well,
many people are, and he's not the only possibility. Of course, people still talk of Hillary. They talk of of Ed Randall, the governor of Pennsylvania, who is was a Clinton Democrat, but much very popular. Former Governor Johnson of Ohio. There's a lineup, of course, people. But Webb is certainly in the ring, you might say.
Well, Jim Webb's new book is called A Time to Fight, Reclaiming a Fair and Just America, and it's published by Broadway Books. And you're on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. And Bob Silvers, editor of the New York Review of Books, and I are having a talk about what's in the latest edition. Now, I'm going to talk about somebody now. I thought this was a fantastic piece by David Gilmour called Garibaldi's Gift. Who would have known, who would have imagined that Garibaldi was such a fantastically interesting bloke? But and also, I mean, your review has written a really funny, funny review.
It's a funny review.
So, okay, we're going to the epic figure of Giuseppe Garibaldi. According to Dave Gilmour, while other heroic Italians have become tarnished as clear historical facts start to eclipse pure nationalistic sentiment, Garibaldi remains an authentic Italian hero, one of the generation of giants who helped to create modern Italy between 1848 and 1870. So tell us about Garibaldi. Who was he, Robert?
Well, he was an Italian who was who started off as a political agitator very much a forthright, a woman loving, drinking, but a man who believed and had adopted from Mazzini the idea of a united Italy. And he worked as a merchant seaman. He went, after he was kicked out of Italy, for being with Mazzini, who had the dream of uniting Italy in the 1830s, when their Italy being divided then into eight different provinces and duchies. He went to South America. He campaigned up and down South America, selling arms, selling goods.
Oh, can I just say here, can I interrupt you here, because the selling goods is so funny. He sails up and down the coast attempting to sell pasta.
Yes.
Apparently they don't really want pasta. And your reviewer David Gilmour says he was not very good at this or any other commercial activity. While he was trying to herd 1,000 oxen to Montevideo, 400 of them drowned in the River Negro. But later on, apparently he resumed his trade as a merchant sailor, but without enthusiasm or much success. He sailed from Peru to China with a cargo of guano, only to find that the Cantonese did not want to buy it.
I know. He was one of these buccaneer adventurers for whom things went wrong, but he was undaunted. And of course, as he says...
Never retreat, he says.
He also saw a young woman through his telescope on the Brazilian coast, fell in love with her through his telescope, the vivacious Anita, and she abandoned her husband, a local cobbler, attached herself to Garibaldi, had four children. They sailed to Europe, and there he started the revolution.
And, of course, after she died, while we're talking about women, Bob, after his South American wife, Anita, died, in the space of 1 year, he had a child with one woman, proposed unsuccessfully to a second, a baroness, fell in love with a third, a countess, and married a fourth, who he rejected soon after for having another man's baby.
Exactly. He was a terrific... And this is part, may I say, of his legend in Italy, that he was a man who had many women, he was a great fighter, he was a great drinker, and he was a great leader.
But he was a great smoker of bad Swiss cigars as well.
He smoked cigars, he was, in other words, everything we associate with the word macho, he was. And he did lead a band of a hastily recruited band of southern Italians into Sicily, which was badly governed by the kingdom of the Bourbon king of two Sicilies, and they did indeed conquer that territory. So that was the beginning of the revolution that gradually, in fact, united Italy, but only by making an alliance with the kingdom of Savoy in Piedmont. So then, as the Kingdom of Savoy and Piedmont and the statesmen around them, like Cavour, they're the ones who set upon the diplomacy and some of the armed activity, which did indeed unite Italy. And Garibaldi was more or less displaced. He was a great hero of the Sicilian campaign. He had some success near Naples, but he was faded away in a way as the military man, while the politicians did indeed form out of the somewhat decrepit various duchies and provinces and kingdoms of Italy, the united Italy we know.
He was also famous around the world, and in England apparently he was adored by the masses. He had a football team, Nottingham Forest, dressed in red shirts to mimic him, or they elected to do this. I mean, he was sounds like a real pop culture hero.
He was, and there's no overestimating the popularity of the Risorgimento in England at the time. It was seen as a great stroke for independence against king against corruption. It was seen as a great stroke against the papacy, because these people were not particularly Catholic. And that is in the sense of the of loyalty to the papal idea. So you can see that in many different factors in England, his charm, his masculinity, his roguishness, his adventures, his women, all these made him into a terrific figure.
And I love the fact that David Gilmour says he has a disastrous effect on poets who wrote some of their worst verses in his honour.
That's true. They know poets could kept. They but there was a feeling you had to write about Garibaldi, and if it was, it turned out, of course, he's a very rough fellow, and it was very hard to capture him.
Well, the book that David Gilmour is reviewing for you is called Garibaldi, Citizen of the World by Alfonso Sirocco and translated to English by Alan Cameron. It does seem to be something of a hagiography, doesn't it?
The book is rather a hagiography, and David Gilmour's review is particularly interesting because he's saying, hey, was it really such a great idea to incorporate the southern provinces into one country? Wasn't Naples really a great city in its time? Maybe the whole southern Italy might have become a something more, you might say, coherent in itself, and not the problem it is for northern Italy. Perhaps yes, it might have had it might indeed have had relations with other Mediterranean countries. It might have been separate, but David Gilmour is calling into question is the whole notion of the Risorgimento as a unification of really quite disparate parts of Italy.
It's a bit of a tough rap to pin on Giuseppe Garibaldi, though, isn't it?
A bit, because he was not
he wasn't
a really
there.
Great politician. He was a kind of would-be warrior. He was a man who enjoyed battle. He was a man who enjoyed women. He was a roustabout, and he was a little bit larger than life.
Well, this book, Garibaldi, Citizen of the World, which I've just spoken about, is published by Princeton University Press. Now, finally, Robert, let's talk about Marguerite Duras, because you've got Edmund White reviewing three new translations of work from this French writer. And in the process, he paints an extraordinary image of her post-war years, her intemperate lurchings from alcoholic deathbed to social centre of attention, and even to writing things in this condition. She drank frightening amounts of alcohol right up to the end.
Yes, it was amazing that she and her, she had a homosexual friend, a kind of companion with whom she lived and about whom she wrote several books and with her when she died. And they would start out by drinking a liter of wine, throw it up, and go on to another liter. At the same time, they were committed to writing at least a sentence a day. So they wrote the sentence of the day and had another liter of wine. She was a woman of extraordinary capacities and toughness and drunkenness, it must be said. Now, of course, what you say that this was after the war, and it's true, she did acquire this reputation, but the revelation of Ed White and of the books he's reviewing is that during the war, she, as we know, she came from a family that had lived in Indochina. She and her family who'd lost their fortunes, and they went back to Paris, and she worked for the French colonial government in Paris. And then, during the occupation, she worked for the occupiers, the Nazis, and she was involved in doling out paper to publishers. And of course, she doled out, as she had to, paper to fascist books, and denied paper to more liberal or anti-fascist books. So this episode in her life has been uncovered in the books we're reviewing, and it is part of a pattern in her life, you might say, of not disclosing rather embarrassing facts.
Although, I mean, I remember reading, I think was it The War in about 1985, where she talks about her husband who'd been taken to a concentration camp and her waiting for him. And then he comes back. And then, I mean, the honesty and with which she says she doesn't love him anymore and she doesn't really want him, even though, I mean, she's got another lover. I mean, it was a kind of searingly honest portrayal.
It was honest, poor fellow. And, of course, she did, toward the end of the war, like so many French, join the resistance and became very involved in the resistance, claimed that she'd actually tortured somebody herself. And, of course, Ed White said, no, I don't think she did. It was just an invention. Mm. There are lots of inventions in her life. She was, and she was quite shameless about it. And the big point of his review and is that she rewrote the same story several times. The Lover, the famous million sales book, she put out again as The North China Lover. The Lover in of a family was poor. It's true her mother encouraged her to take up with someone from China. And in the original version, this man was rather looked like a monkey. He was rather not particularly handsome, but he had some money. Now, in the later versions of the book, he gets handsomer and handsomer, and richer and richer, and sexier and sexier.
Well, you know, everybody looks good when you've had a few litres of wine.
Exactly.
Well, look, these three new translations of Marguerite Duras's books are reviewed in the latest New Review of Books by Edmund White, and they're all published by the New Press. They are The Wartime Writings, 1943 to 1949, The War, a Memoir, and The North China Lover. And all the articles we've been discussing are in the upcoming issue of the New Review of Books, the issue dated the 26th of June. And, of course, we'll put details of all the books on our website. And I've been speaking with the editor of the New York Review of Books, Robert Silvers, in his New York office. Robert, thank you again for speaking
to
me on the book show.
It's good to talk to you.
And you're on ABC Radio National with me, Ramona Koval. Populated rock pool after the tide has gone out. That's one way Brisbane has been described, in this case by Betty Churcher in the 1960s. The ebb and flow of that tide reveals the bursts of energy that have defined Brisbane's history. Different phases of Brisbane's life have been imagined by many different writers, David Malouf with his novel Jono, the poet Tom Shapcott, Jeanette Turner Hospital, and Thea Astley. Simon Cleary has added to this picture of Brisbane in his debut novel, The Comfort of Figs. The construction of the Story Bridge across the Brisbane River in the late 1930s was a key moment in its coming-of-age story, and Simon Cleary weaves the story of its construction with a contemporary story of a man called Robbie, who's struggling in his relationship with his girlfriend Freya and is estranged from his father, who built that bridge. Rather than being a builder, as his father would have liked, Robbie plants trees, fig trees. For the book show Sarah Lestrange, Simon Cleary spoke to her about The Comfort of Figs, and he begins by talking about Brisbane as the setting for this book.
In this book, certainly, Brisbane as a city is very strongly the setting, and in some ways the book, through its protagonist Robbie, is something of a creation story for the city. So in some senses, the city features very, very strongly in this book.
You have the historical elements about the construction of the bridge throughout the book, and historical elements about the founding of Brisbane as well. But it's told through a personal story of a son trying to come to terms with this structure that his father built, and they are not on speaking terms with each other.
No, the son has reacted very strongly to his father and who he sees his father as being and the forces that he feels his father has exerted on him. So he's reacted strongly against that, and in many ways he has chosen a path in life in opposition to his father's.
And that opposition is bound up in his love and obsession and fascination with the fig tree. He gets up every morning before dawn and plants fig trees.
Mm.
He's got his own creation story going there.
He does, and the fig tree, of course, harks back as well to the story of Genesis, a creation story for Western culture. But Robbie, as the protagonist, is obsessed by figs, and he's seeking to reclaim his city and to return it to a Garden of Eden-type state, in opposition to the forces that his father, a bridge builder and engineer, have exerted on the city. So as a reaction to the sort of city that his father has been busy creating.
Which is, as is commented in the book, a replica. Many elements of the city of Brisbane are replicas, like the botanical gardens and the bridge itself.
It was very interesting to me in the research that I did in the book, and then as I tried to express it in the book itself, that at the time the construction of the Story Bridge was seen as being a Queensland-owned event, and there was a slogan that was used at the time that it was built by Queenslanders for Queenslanders of Queensland material. So it was very, very important that the whole event, this Depression-era employment generation project for Queensland, was seen as part of Queensland's identity. And yet, at the same time, there was a bridge which is so very similar to it, which 5 years previously had been completed in Montreal in Canada. So this whole question about one's identity and where one obtains one's identity from, and the uniqueness of that identity, is a very interesting one.
And you pit the symbol of the bridge, this cold, hard structure of steel, this symbol of cities trying to embrace modernism, against the softness of the fig. Figs, as we know, when they drop to the ground, get all soft and mushy very quickly. And is this representing the heart or the people in the city who aren't cold and like steel?
In some ways, it was an attempt to describe the complexities of cities, which are built layer upon layer, story upon story, event upon event, by the people who live in them. And the people who live in them are all sorts of people. You have your engineers, you have your artistic people. There are people who feel a very deep affinity to the land and to the natural world. So it was a way of trying to describe a Brisbane which was capable of accommodating those complexities and those layers.
Your book being called The Comfort of Figs, the figs are really only a comfort to Robbie.
Yes. Robbie's father, Jack, is consumed by his engineering achievements and wishes to hand that love and that passion on to his son, Robbie, who has no interest in it. It's not in his nature at all. And so his father is blinded to Robbie as a person. And ironically, and in a sense tragically for Robbie and some of his relationships, he becomes blinded in a similar way to the needs of his girlfriend, and he becomes obsessed by his love of figs. They're a comfort to him, but at one level only in a temporary and in a superficial sense. I'll read a selection from The Comfort of Figs, and this is a reflection by Robbie on what the figs mean to him. Usually you miss these moments. They pass and you are unaware they paused before you, humble, waiting. The hollowing of the air before a breeze changes direction, the touch of a jacaranda flower on your shoulder as it falls, the suspended moment between dark and light when dawn emerges, infinite, uncertain. One October's day, summer's long ascendancy close, his morning's private planting complete, he moves across the city and something catches him, the rising sun illuminating a bunch of purple fruit in the canopy of a huge Moreton Bay fig, the fruit, the figs, candescent in the sun's rays. The tree's size comes from its trunk, with its enormous, tangled, twisting, buttress-rooted girth, and from the canopy, scraggy and uneven and vast, its large leaves growing in hands, green dark, like giant upward-pointing fingers, and each bunch of figs resting in the palm of a hand of leaves. The underside of some of the leaves, the younger, adolescent leaves, is dusty brown, looking prematurely aged. Robbie climbs this tree on impulse, drawn to the figs as if they are jewels, as if he is a boy again, as if he is suddenly 10 years of age and fleeing his father, seeking refuge. He collects the figs, as many as he can, snapping them off between finger and thumb, rubbing each purple globe against his shirt, polishing them. When his pockets are full, Robbie descends, surrendering the tree to the birds. On the ground, he wonders if he might make something of them for Freya, some gift. Somehow he needs to tell her about the figs, how these trees had given him direction, how, in a flash of understanding, in the stenciled shadow of steel girders, he'd seen that where his father had erected bridges, he would plant trees. He wants to tell Freya that he was saved by these fig trees, their solidity, their toughness.
Simon Cleary reading from his debut novel, The Comfort of Figs, looking at the story of the construction of the bridge, forms the basis and the backdrop for the rift between father and son, it seems, is something that happened during that construction of the bridge, when the workers on the bridge were asking themselves, have the planners of this bridge incorporated into their plans how many men are going to die? Because the cost of constructing such things means that inevitably men will die.
It's another paradox that an undertaking like building a bridge is seen as a great romantic civil undertaking that binds together the people of a city, in this case Brisbane, but at the same time they come at a cost. And it's often been the case that these great engineering or construction achievements, whether it be the pyramids, the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Hoover Dam in America, the skyscrapers of New York, and the Story Bridge in Brisbane, they come at a human cost. And it's a common experience for workers, for labourers on the bridges to die. And in this story, a group of workers become consumed by that question. To what degree is it planned? To what degree do the engineers understand how many people are projected to die on this bridge? How many people must be sacrificed so that the city can have this wonderful, iconic creation?
But as part of this questioning, it sets in motion a process in which means that someone does die as a result and has implications for future generations. So in this creation story, the history lingers.
And it does, and history so often has intergenerational impacts, and the death of one of the key characters on the bridge and the circumstances in which he falls to his death from the bridge, they have these repercussions, the repercussions through the generations and repercussions that Robbie is still feeling reverberating against him as he's growing up and seeking to understand his own identity and to forge a place in the world.
It seems like you did a lot of research to build this story.
I did, and I had a wonderful head start in that my great-grandfather had been an engineer on the Story Bridge, and I had access to his private papers. They opened a window into the construction of the bridge, and I went through that window and spent time in the State Library in Brisbane and at the National Library in Canberra to learn a little more about the environment in which the Story Bridge during the second half of the 1930s was built. And it was a wonderfully exciting thing to do.
But you also look at the discovery by the colonisers of the Brisbane River as well. You go back beyond the Story Bridge to build this picture of Brisbane.
And I was trying to draw in different dimensions of the creation story. So at one level, the Story Bridge was symbolic of the settlement by Western culture of what had been Indigenous territory, and I sought to go back and to explore that in different ways as well, and to look at what the country looked like as the first Europeans were sailing up the Brisbane River in a whaleboat, to look at how some of the creeks that fed into the Brisbane River might have looked like before then. So they were ways of exploring, in a sense, this creation story of Brisbane as a city.
But what about Brisbane now and how it looks back on that past? How do you imagine that?
It's interesting how a city incorporates events into its sense of self, and how we as people incorporate events in our past into our sense of self as well. And that's something that Robbie, the protagonist, is grappling with. He is passionate and romantic about the natural environment, and yet he is also confronted by the love of his girlfriend, which is, she's an activist and she's interested in opposing, in a political sense, the development in the city. And while on the face of it, it would look like those two drives, Robbie's love for the planting figs and his activist girlfriend's commitment to activism, would stand together well, they're different emphases, and Robbie finds it difficult to grapple with the political nature of her work. He's much simpler, and like many romantics, perhaps he doesn't have a great political dimension. So part of his journey is to understand what it means to operate at a political level as well.
In the late 90s, there were lots of protests in Brisbane about planned changes, many of which are now happening or have happened. So some of that past fury has kind of been quelled, hasn't it?
Yes, and no. I think there is a sense of dynamism in Brisbane at the moment, and you look at developments such as the recent GOMA, the Gallery of Modern Art on the South Bank, the new State Library on the South Bank, which are almost universally lauded as being wonderful pieces of architectural development. And there's an acceptance that that sort of development is actually a way of celebrating a city. There are still campaigns, though, in Brisbane to oppose development in suburbs and some of the bridges that have been proposed for the river and the tunnels underground. So there is still a strong level of community opposition to some projects. Though, as you say, this sense of the dynamism and the sense of celebrating Brisbane as a city is very real at the moment.
And one of the ways that cities can be celebrated is through their writing.
Yes, and it's true that so many of my literary heroes have written about places, and Maloof is one of those. The way that he has written about Brisbane in a number of books, Jono, the most obvious one, is something that is just wonderful and has added so much to the richness of the city.
That's Simon Cleary speaking with a book show's Sarah Lestrange about his debut novel, The Comfort of Figs. It's published by the University of Queensland Press. On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Ramona Koval. Dutch writer, journalist and historian Geert Mak has written several books about places, including Amsterdam, A Brief Life of the City, and Jorvard, The Death of the Village in Late 20th Century Europe. His latest book is called The Bridge, A Journey Between Orient and Occident, and in it he focuses on one bridge in the city of Istanbul and the people who cross it, who work on it, and who are drawn to it. So make a note of that for later on today after 10 a.m. Remember, you can hear this program again by going to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Download us as a podcast, find today's guest and book details there too, and you can send us an email if you like. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.